All right, let's get underway. Are there any leftover questions that I haven't we haven't talked about outside of class? All right, so today, our last lecture in this course, we're going to talk about NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, and we're going to aim our discussion about talking about it as a way of doing quantum computing, and this is in part to keep ourselves honest as theorists. From time to time, it's useful to think about the real world, and you know, boy, there's nothing realer than a bunch of nuclei with spins and magnetic fields. And secondly, turns out to be a really interesting way of illuminating and illustrating some of the ideas we've talked about in the last 2 days, ideas of using the rules of quantum theory to accomplish information processing. And so we're going to start out here. Oh, by the way, for today, with the exception of one slide, H bar equals 1. And there's actually a really nice reason for this. And that's because if you take H bar equal to 1, then energies are frequencies. And in NMR, people who do NMR are always thinking about frequencies. They're always thinking about frequencies of typically radio frequency signals. So this is a very convenient approximation, a very convenient idealization. No, what is it? It's a rationalization of units for this purpose. I'll throw it in one equation or two, just so it's easier to think about that equation in conventional units. But here we go. Okay, wow, this really does work. Okay, so we're going to imagine a nuclear spin like a proton, a hydrogen nucleus, in a magnetic field, and maybe we have a really big 10 Tesla magnetic field, strong but achievable. And I've violated my own moral principles, and I've actually drawn this thing as a little ball with a little spin vector. Okay, but I needed a picture somewhere in these slides, so here it is. Here's my picture. All right, now the nuclear magnetic moment of the proton couples to the external field. And so you have some Hamiltonian that results, which is just the coupling of the magnetic moment in the field. We'll take the field to be in the z direction, or better yet, we'll take the z direction to be the direction of the field. And then we get something like this, with omega being the so-called Larmor frequency, which is a function of the magnetic moment and the strength of the field. And we've defined this to be omega over 2. That's handy for later on. And so here we go. Omega over 2 pi, the circular frequency associated with this, is about 425.7 megahertz. Now, if you look at an NMR machine that you buy from some company like Bruker or something, and you look on the outside, then in large friendly letters it will have a frequency, so many megahertz. So maybe the name of it will be, it's the Bruker 500. That means that a proton in its field would process, or would have a Larmor frequency of 500 megahertz. That's what that means. Okay. So, this is really getting experimental, where I'm telling you how to read the product catalogs for the equipment vendor. Okay, so here we go. Now, the time evolution, considering only this external field, would be given by a unitary operator like this. And I can actually do this. It's very easy to take the exponential of a Pauli operator. And it's just a cosine term sub the identity plus a sine term times z. Okay, that's how things evolve. Okay. But of course, that's not the whole story. Because in addition to the external field, there are other things that may be happening. This may be the strongest thing that's happening, but there are other things that are happening. So the actual Hamiltonian that actually controls the time evolution has got other stuff in it too. It's got the external field part, but then there are the other effects. Those other effects may include the effects of the local magnetic field due to the molecular environment. It may have to do with some external perturbation to the magnetic field that we apply, like we send in a radio wave or something. That would all be right there inside of H. So let's think about what's present in that extra piece of the Hamiltonian. What we're going to do is we're going to try to separate out its effects from everything else. So we're going to adopt what's called the rotating frame picture. And the rotating frame picture is basically to adopt the Heisenberg picture for H0, but the Schrodinger picture for the rest. And this is sometimes called the interaction picture. But this is how it's going to be. What we're going to do is we're going to define our new state to be the real state, and then we're going to multiply it by U0 dagger. Now, because this is not the whole time evolution, this thing itself might still depend on time. But if the extra piece of the time evolution is small somehow, then this may vary much more slowly. And similarly, the extra piece of the Hamiltonian becomes an operator which itself depends on time, even if the original extra piece of the Hamiltonian doesn't. We'll consider cases both where it does and where it doesn't. Yeah?
U dagger is just a conjugation using U dagger instead of just U?
I'm sorry. Say it again?
To evolve freely the state, uh-huh, using U dagger.
Oh, no, this is not U dagger. I'm unevolving the state. This is already U times the original state. If the only time evolution were U0, then this would be U0 dagger, U0 psi of 0, and this would be fixed. So this is actually taking whatever the state is and sort of backing it up in time as if there were only the external field acting. Okay? And so that's this undoes, in a certain sense, the evolution due to the external field. That's why it's a U dagger. Okay? Other questions? All right. So this, if you work it out, it's not too hard to show that the Schrodinger equation for the picture in the rotating frame. Why do I call it the rotating frame? Well, because the net effect of the external field is to cause the spin to precess around, and this sort of subtracts off that precession. That's like rotating your picture so that the precession, that just that precession would be fixed, and you're only left with other things. So in the rotating frame, you have a very simple Schrodinger equation, which only involves the rotating frame version of the extra piece of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is, we can't beat this. This is pretty simple. Okay, this is, as I said before, this is related to the interaction picture that you often see, where you have a Hamiltonian that maybe you have two systems that are have three pieces of the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is system A, the Hamiltonian is system B, and an interaction term. And you adopt the Heisenberg picture for system A and system B Hamiltonian pieces. But you leave behind the interaction picture so you can see how the interaction causes transitions between stationary states of the independent Hamiltonian. So that's interaction picture in a nutshell. And the idea here is that our reference frame, it's really a reference frame in the Hilbert space, of course, is precessing at omega like an unperturbed nuclear spin would. Okay, so far so good? Everybody happy? Yeah. Yeah, but inertial frames aren't such a big deal when you're talking about precessing angular momenta. I mean, even the free precession, if you think about it classically, even the free motion of a spinning object is not necessarily simple. Okay, so yeah, this would certainly be a non-inertial. No, it's not exactly, no. Take that back. I don't know how to answer that question. Because as we'll see, this is a useful heuristic, but this is not really what's going on. As we will see, this is not exactly what I mean. Okay, so now, what kinds of term? What does this look like? What does this Hamiltonian look like? Well, let's see what kind of terms could be in the original guy. Well, there could be a bunch of terms like this. And for now, let's suppose that all these guys are constant or slowly varying. So I've got terms of this type. And any Hamiltonian whatsoever could be written like this with appropriate real coefficients here. Okay? Since I have an operator basis here. And so what do these things look like? What do these various terms look like in the rotating frame picture? That's the question I want to ask. Well, let's see. We have these guys, and we're going to transform them this way. And where that unitary is just a combination of the identity and z. And so we can actually work this out very nicely because we know all about the algebra of the poly operators. We know, for example, that the product of two poly operators is plus or minus I times the third one. We know that the square of each poly operator is the identity. We know that that if you put a poly operator between two others, so like x, or better yet, zxz, that'll show up here somewhere. That gives you minus x. Okay? We know all those things. So by using those things, we can actually put this operator after it and its conjugate before, and work out what this is. And we find the following. This is the great thing about PowerPoint. So I'm going to skip all the details. But actually, this is not hard. This is not hard. You can easily do this. The way we do it is we figure out how the poly, a rotating frame, affects the poly operators. We just stick in a poly operator here. We see what we get. Of course, if we have the identity, we just get u naught dagger u naught. We get the identity. And z is not affected because z commutes with u naught. Okay? However, the x and y are affected. And they show up in combinations like this. The x and y parts actually precess relative to the old guys. The new guys are precessing around with a frequency omega. The z is fixed, but the other guys are going around very fast. And omega may be really big, hundreds of megahertz, easily achievable. So the rotating frame Hamiltonian will look like this. Here it is. This is our rotating frame Hamiltonian. Well, allow me to point out a couple of things about this. First of all, there's this thing. And all of this does is this shifts the energy of the system overall by a constant. It adds an energy to the system. And I don't care about that. It really isn't very important. It actually doesn't really change anything. So I'm going to ignore this. We're just going to ignore terms in the Hamiltonian that are something times a constant, a constant rather times one. And also, these guys oscillate rapidly in time. These parts of the Hamiltonian are fluctuating around at a frequency of several hundred megahertz. And that means that if you look at their behavior, it turns out that their net contribution over time periods longer than that oscillation frequency, over time periods much longer than that, these have negligible contribution to the net behavior of the system. If I have a particle flying through an electric field that is maybe not very strong and is fluctuating back and forth, then the net effect on the particle is effectively zero. And so it turns out that in the situation where omega is very large compared to these things, all these things, of course, are energies. Omega and the E's are all energies. Where omega is very large compared to this, then over time, these terms have negligible net contribution to the time evolution. And so, that leaves us with the last guy, this guy. So in fact, the effective Hamiltonian for a rapidly precessing spin is just something like this. And in fact, you can see what this dot, what this is. This is called the chemical shift. It basically represents a mismatch between the omega that we gave, and the actual precession frequency. If we adopted a rotating picture in this, there's still a little rotation left over. So okay, we have a Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian is of this form when we adopt the rotating frame picture, the effective Hamiltonian. The other stuff averages to zero almost at once. Questions? Okay. So now we want to start messing with our system. So what we're going to do is we're going to let this extra Hamiltonian include not only terms from the local molecular environment of the spin, which might contribute some magnetic field, but also from the effects of a radio frequency pulse transmitted into the system. And so here we go. What we're going to do is we're going to introduce this time-dependent perturbation, which looks like this. And this corresponds to a circularly polarized radio wave. This is the magnetic field due to the circularly polarized radio wave pulse. And it's circularly polarized sort of in the direction of the, we send it in along the z-axis, it's circularly polarized in the direction of the precession, and it's at a frequency omega prime. It's got its own frequency, and it's got its particular phase phi, and then it's got an envelope function, which depends on time. So we turn the pulse on and off. We don't just send a continual pulse. We turn the pulse on and off. Okay, so in the rotating frame, we can actually transform this guy. And you'd think that all of the x's and y's would go away. But what actually really happens is when you work these things out and you apply a couple of trig identities for sum and difference formulas for angles, you get this. You get a of t, you get the envelope function, and you get the x and y terms that are the cosine and sine of the difference of the frequencies times time plus the phase angle. And this averages very quickly to zero unless, to very high precision, the frequency of your radio pulse and your precession frequency match. But this is not going to have much effect on your system unless you tune the frequency of your radio pulse to be in resonance with the natural precession frequency of your system. After all, this is nuclear magnetic resonance. Okay? And so what happens if you do that? What happens if you tune the frequency omega prime to be equal to omega? What happens? Well, what happens is you get a resonant pulse. The resonant pulse produces a Hamiltonian in the rotating frame like this. And this is time dependent because you turn the pulse on and off. Okay? It's time dependent here, but this part in parentheses is constant, is not time dependent. It's a constant operator, which means that it doesn't average to zero. And what can we actually control here? Well, by very fine control of our radio signal, we can control how the pulse turns on and off. We can control A. We can turn it on. We can turn it off. A can increase or decrease. We can make it a strong pulse or a weak pulse. We can make it a wide pulse or a narrow pulse. We can do all that with controlling A. Right, well, I'll just leave it at that. But then we can also control phi, which is the relative phase of the pulse, of the radio pulse, and the precession, the precession frequency. What precession? What precession is this? Well, this is actually the precession of our frame, of our rotating frame. So how do we actually do this experimentally? Well, inside the NMR machine, there's an oscillator, a very high precision oscillator, which sort of gives timing signals to everything. Okay? And what we do, the oscillator is the thing that defines the rotating frame, omega. And this phase difference is how the radio pulse is shifted in time with respect to that internal oscillator of the NMR machine. Okay? So great, now we can, if we use a resonant pulse, the resonant pulse can actually have an effect, can contribute a controllable Hamiltonian of this form to the system. So we can steer our spin system. Questions at this point? Yeah, I know this is boring, but it's going to get interesting, I promise. Okay, so we've got radio pulses. What happens when we use one of those resonant pulses? What can we do with it? We've got our effective Hamiltonian for our resonant radio pulse. It's A of t times a constant operator, which is some combination of x and y, some combination of the things perpendicular to the z direction. Okay. Well, let's see. There's the sort of total strength of the resonant pulse that we can think about. This is the total amount of pulse there is. It's the integral of the pulse. If the pulse could be broad and not very strong, or it could be short and very strong to have the same total strength. And we're going to call that beta over 2. And the reason we're going to call it beta over 2 instead of just beta is because that'll allow us to agree with some previous things we worked out about rotation operators for spin 1/2 systems. Okay. All right, so this is our... this is the strength of the pulse, is sort of the total area under the envelope curve here, and that total area determines what kinds of net effect there are. If we choose phi equal to 0, then this is A of t x, and if we choose phi equal to pi over 2, this is just A of t times y. So by choosing the phase either 0 or pi over 2, we can, let's say, either exactly in phase with the oscillator or shifted back by a quarter of a period, then we can produce operators like this. These are unitary operators describing the net effect of an x pulse, a pulse with phi equal to 0, of total strength beta over 2. And notice that this is in fact exactly equal to the rotation operator for a spin about the x-axis by the angle beta over 2. Right? You recognize that? You have to think back a couple of weeks. Okay, and so that's equal to this. That's easy to figure out. And then you could do it if you set phi equal to pi over 2. You could pick out only the y term, and you could get an operator that's a rotation about the y-axis by beta over 2. So we can rotate the spins around the x-axis or the y-axis by any angle we choose, simply by adjusting the profile of our pulse and the phase of the pulse. So that's pretty nice control. And what I want to argue is that this lets us do anything we like. Okay? So for example, you can see very easily that if we put in a pi pulse, a pulse where this total strength here is pi over 2. If we put in a pi pulse, then we can make a pi x pulse, then we can make the operator minus I times x. You can easily see that from this. Just insert pi for beta. And then this term is 0, and that term is minus I sine this. And there's a minus I in front of it, but we don't worry about that too much, because that's just an overall phase in the state vector of the system. And who cares about an overall phase in the state vector of a system? It doesn't make any difference. So if we can make minus I times x, we can make x. That's equivalent to making x. Not true for a controlled operator, but it's true for just a one qubit operator. And similarly, we can use a pi pulse, a pulse where beta is equal to pi, to make minus I y. So we can rotate. These guys are 180 degree rotations about the x and y axes. They switch. You can think of these as being rotations on the block sphere. On the block sphere, as I've described. These are 180 degree rotations of the block sphere. About x and y. It's nice to think about the block sphere. That's very easy. Okay, so we can use combinations of these things to make more complicated things. For example, since we can make x and y, we can make z. We can make x and y, and we can make z. And we can also make my favorite gate, the Hadamard. Okay? And that's a little trickier. That's a little trickier. First, you need to rotate by pi over 2 about y, and then rotate by pi about x. That works. You want to work it out? Shall we work this out? I need to check myself. Let's do this one. Okay? All right. So we need to slow down. All right. Let's see. Let's write out matrix forms for these guys. For these. So I've got Rx by of beta. That's equal to. Well, let's see. The cosine terms appear on the diagonal. I've got cosine beta over 2. And cosine of beta over 2. And the minus I sine is off diagonal. And in x, of course, I would have 1 and 1 here. So this is just going to be minus I sine of beta over 2 minus I sine of beta over 2. Does anybody find this vaguely familiar? Yeah, OK. All right, good. I knew somebody would. OK. Anyway, so then there's also Ry around beta, and that's just the same with one difference. And that difference is that these off-diagonal terms are going to be multiplied by minus I here and I here, because that's what the components of the Pauli Y matrix are. And so I multiply by minus I here, and I get minus sine of beta over 2. Sine of beta over 2. Oh, yeah, that's kind of vaguely familiar, too. You've probably seen operators something like this. So let's write down this sequence. So I've got a rotation about the x by pi. A rotation about x by pi will give me 0 on the diagonal and minus I on the two diagonals, right? So I'll have 0 minus I 0. That's going to be a rotation about the x by pi. But first, I'm going to do a rotation about the y by pi over 2. That was my claim. Boy, I hope this works. I really don't know. I mean, I checked it out, but I was sleepy. So let's figure out what it is. And if it's wrong, we'll fix it. Let's see. That's a rotation by pi over 2. So I feed in beta equal to pi over 2 here. What's the cosine of pi over 4? 1 over root 2, which is the same as this. That's 1 over root 2. So I should look here. I have 1 over root 2 here in all these places. So let me just take an overall factor of 1 over root 2 out and write down 1 minus 1, 1, 1, which looks promising. Okay, now I'm going to have a 1 over the square root of 2 out front, 1 over the square root of 2, and then I'll have this multiplied by that gives me minus I. This multiplied by that gives me minus I. This multiplied by that gives me minus I. Ah, but this multiplied by that gives me plus I because the minus I hits the minus 1. So I get I here, which is equal to minus I times 1 over the square root of 2, 1, 1, 1, minus 1, which is equal to minus I times our Hadamard. Okay. The point is that we can put these things together to make any one qubit gate up to an overall phase. We might have things multiplied by I. Got a lot of things multiplied by minus I here, but that's okay. That's okay. So up to overall phase, we can make anything. We can make anything. Okay, are we okay? I keep bumping this until it's swinging, so the letters kind of wave. But you have any questions about what's there? All right. Yeah. Yeah, I know, and I've only got one qubit here, and what you know, this doesn't look very good. I need more. I need more. But if I just talking about what I can do to a single qubit, to a single nuclear spin, I can do anything I want to it. Any unitary operator up to overall phase, I can do with my NMR machine. Okay? Yeah?
How would you build a phase gate?
How would you build a phase gate? Okay, the phase gate, the thing that you're going to actually be making for the phase gate would be a gate which had entries like this, e to the i beta over 2 and e to the minus I beta over 2. And what a and then that's up to an overall phase, the phase gate. If I multiply this by e to the minus I beta over 2, then that's equal to 1 e to the minus I beta. That's a phase gate, right? Does that make sense? So this is the kind of thing that I can make. And you'll notice that that is a rotation about the z-axis by beta over 2. So what I have to do is I have to come up with a geometrical way of building such rotations out of rotations about x and y. And you can do that. So one of the things you can do is rotate by y to take the x-axis and put it along the z-axis, then rotate around that by somewhat. Then undo that rotation to put the x-axis back, and that would something like that would be a way to make that kind of rotation. I'd have to think about that a little bit more.
Isn't there a problem because we don't get an actual overall phase because it will depend on the angle that we are rotating?
Oh well, the overall phase, for example, does not affect the density operator at all. Because the density operator is always affected by u, rho, u dagger. Okay? And since it doesn't affect the density operator at all, an overall phase can have no experimental consequences. So if we make this, it will be experimentally indistinguishable from making this. Okay? All right. Other questions? All right. So now we can steer around qubits, but steering around qubits, that's not enough. We need more. We need 2 spins, at least. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to adopt a rotating frame for both spins. That is to say, each spin couples to the external magnetic field, and therefore each spin will have a Larmor frequency. And so our rotating frame is going to be defined by the time evolution operator for that precession. But notice that omega 1 and omega 2 might not be the same. omega 1 and omega 2 might not be the same, and generally aren't. In fact, for reasons that we'll see later, you really don't want them to be. And so, since these guys are not equal, you can't really think of this as just a rotation in space. It's, your frame of reference is really a frame in the Hilbert space. This is like adopting a frame of reference that's spinning at this rate for this spin at a different rate for the other spin. Okay? So it's not just like looking at the thing in a rotating frame of reference, which is why it's easy to get confused, which is both why I originally didn't answer Tibbetra's question correctly and then later said, no, you really can't think of this as a non-inertial frame because it's not just taking your spatial coordinates and moving around. It's the frame of reference in the Hilbert space, and you adopt a different kind of transformation in the part of the Hilbert space in the factor, the tensor product factor associated with spin 1 and the one associated with spin 2. Okay? They're different. All right. So you do that. So what kind of terms are you going to have in the Hamiltonian of the two spins? What kind of terms are there in principle? And I've written out a whole bunch. That operator has to be a linear combination of these product operators, these 16 product operators. Whatever it is, I don't know what it is, but let's suppose it's slowly varying. It's got to be a linear combination of all these guys. Okay? I don't know what kind of linear combination it is. But what does that look like in the rotating frame? When I apply this operator before and after, what does it look like? Well, these guys, all the ones that involve x's and y's, are going to wind up with rapidly oscillating sines and cosines. Rapidly oscillating according to these rapid precession frequencies. So all of these guys are going to be rapidly oscillating terms. And they oscillate so rapidly, they make no net contribution to the long-term evolution of the system in the rotating frame. In the rotating frame. And therefore, I'll ignore them. They average to zero. They rapidly average to zero. And of course, in addition to that, there's this guy, which is just an overall shift in the energy, which I will ignore, because an overall shift in the energy is like an overall rotation of the phase with time, and has no observable effect. So that just leaves me with three terms. There are only going to be three terms in the effective Hamiltonian for these two spins. What have we got here? Let's see what it is. Here it is. I just wrote it again, but now I have labels. Okay, there's a term which is a chemical shift, which sort of shifts the precession frequency of spin 1 from the free precession frequency. Because, you know, its surroundings might change its precession frequency a little bit. That would be taken care of by this term. And there's a similar term for spin 2. And then there's an interaction term, potentially. An interaction term, which is a Z tensor Z term. And the interaction term actually does exist between pairs of spins in molecules. And the principal effect that contributes to this is something called J-coupling, which is an interaction between nuclear spins that's mediated by the electrons in a covalent bond. It's not just the direct dipole-dipole interaction, which is incredibly weak. It's much stronger than this, and it's mediated by their common interaction with shared electrons between those atoms. And that means that this J coupling is present when the atoms have a covalent bond between them. Okay? And the coupling between between atoms that don't have covalent bonds between them is much less. So this is kind of cool. When you draw one of those molecular structure diagrams, you're also kind of drawing a coupling diagram, potentially, for J coupling between the atoms. So here we go. We've got an interaction between them, and interaction is good, because maybe we can use the interaction, to do something so the qubits can talk to each other. Okay? All right, so we got that. Let's look at a real example. Chloroform. And what I'm going to do with chloroform is I'm going to, this has just got a proton in its nucleus, unless it's deuterium, but most hydrogen's not. This, I'm going to specially look at ones of these guys which have carbon 13. Carbon 12 is spin zero. This carbon 12 nucleus is spin zero. It doesn't have a magnetic moment. It's sort of boring. But carbon 13 is spin 1/2. It has a magnetic moment. And its precession frequency is almost exactly 1/4 the precession frequency of the proton. One of them was 425.7 megahertz in 10 teslas. Well, the carbon 13 in 10 teslas is 107.0 megahertz. So it's almost exactly 1/4. I don't know of any easy way to see why it should be so close to 1/4. Because there's a lot of stuff going into that magnetic moment. But anyway, so that's a handy rule of thumb to have, though. So let's go back. Here, so we've got these guys. They're also the chlorines. What about the chlorines? Well, the chlorines are spin 3/2. There are two common isotopes of chlorine. There's chlorine 35. There's chlorine 37. Both of them are spin 3/2. And you might think, oh my goodness, this is going to be, this is going to really make things complicated. And it does, except it turns out that chlorine nuclei have a non-zero electric quadrupole moment. Okay? Well, so what? So why do they have not? What use is that? Well, electric quadrupole moments couple with the local molecular fields much more strongly. Electric fields are typically much stronger couplings than magnetic fields. And in a liquid sample, if we're looking at a liquid sample, the molecules are tumbling around. So what you've got is you've got these electric quadrupoles inside electric fields, and the electric fields vary with space, so they are coupled, which are tumbling around extremely rapidly. And what that does is that drags these guys around incredibly fast, and their contribution averages to zero almost exclusively. They do make they are important for one other reason, which I'll talk about later. But basically, the chlorine atoms, the chlorine nuclei, are so completely screwed up by their molecular environment, which is fluctuating around so rapidly because the molecules are tumbling around, that it's as if they weren't there at all. Yeah. Actually not. The experiments that we're talking about are at room temperature.
Really?
Yeah.
So and then they're going much faster than say the your oscillating phase.
Sure. Going much faster than they're going much faster than the time scales associated with their interactions with the carbon. I don't know if they're going much faster than a precession frequency. Their interaction with the carbons, it averages to zero. There is a little bit left over, and I don't a little bit left over that makes a difference. Basically, the difference it makes is they act as an environment for the carbon atoms. The carbon atoms interact with them. The carbon nuclei interact with them, and they're interacting with the molecular environment very rapidly. And so, in fact, they contribute to the open system dynamics of the other spins. So that'll be important. But I really like molecules that have nothing in them but chlorine, carbon, and hydrogen, because they're easy to understand. These guys have very different resonant frequencies, and so by the way, since the resonant frequencies of these two guys are so very different, this is over 400 megahertz for 10 teslas. This is just over 100 megahertz. That means that I can tune up radio pulses that are resonant with the protons, or radio pulses that are resonant with the carbon 13 nuclei, and I can separately address them. If I want to mess with the carbon 13 nucleus, I send in one kind of pulse. If I want to mess with the proton, I send in the other kind of pulse, and the pulses are kind of invisible to the other nuclei. So that's a good thing. And finally, there's a J coupling between these guys. There's a J coupling between these guys. And it has this value here has a value of about 1350 inverse seconds. Which means that if you wait a few milliseconds, this guy will have a lot of effect. In order for this guy to have an effect on your system, you just have to wait for a certain amount of time on the order of a few milliseconds. Okay? So this is a nice thing to do experiments. I've actually myself done experiments with things like this. This very molecule with carbon-13 and nuclear magnetic resonance experiments to do quantum computing. We did the one-bit Deutsch-Jose problem with our 300 megahertz NMR machine over in the chemistry department. So, you know, it's even people who don't know what they're doing can do this. All right, so so here's the problem. Here's our thing. We've got chemical shifts, and we've also got our J coupling, which looks like a good thing for making these guys interact with each other. And so all we have to do, the J coupling is an interaction between the spins, and so we can use it to cause the spins to have some kind of non-trivial effect on each other just by adding a time delay on the order of milliseconds. That's the good news. The bad news is, during this time delay, it's not just this part of the Hamiltonian that's acting, also these parts. Right? And I don't want these parts. I want to get rid of them. I want to throw them away. Okay? There's a profound philosophical point at this. This sounds like just an experimental difficulty. There's a profound philosophical point here. And this is a philosophical point that I want to convey to you. And that is, when we talk about quantum information and quantum computing and stuff, we often say, well, let's sort of design up our Hamiltonian to do such and such, or you know, design this unitary operation. Honestly, you and I are just totally stuck with the Hamiltonian of the universe as it is. Okay? We hope that Hamiltonian has pieces that we can exploit for our purposes. But basically, we're stuck with the Hamiltonian that nature gave us. It really isn't something that actually does have knobs. What we're really doing is we're really changing the states of some systems and hope that will change the effect of Hamiltonian of some subsystem of the universe. But we're stuck with nature's Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian that nature gave us in here. We can make some external perturbations by radio frequency pulses. But we're stuck with this. So what do we do? And the answer is something called refocusing, which is magic. So let's consider a single spin. It's easiest to think about this with a single spin. It's got some Hamiltonian like this, and I hate that Hamiltonian. I want to get rid of it. I don't want that Hamiltonian to act. I want to turn it off. Okay? Unfortunately, instead of being turned off, it's on, and so over a period of time t, it has this effect on my system. But suppose before that period of time and after that period of time, I applied an X pulse, a pulse that accomplished the X operation, a R sub X of pi. And I don't worry about the overall phase. Suppose I apply an X pulse. Well, then I remember that XZX is minus Z. Oh, yeah. We mentioned that before. XZX is minus Z, right? And what that means is that every term in this power series will pick up either a minus sign or not, depending on whether there's an even number or odd number of Z's in it. And so this actually switches from the exponential of minus I e t z to exponential I e t z. In other words, if I first flip the spin around the x-axis, and then did my same interval of time and then flipped the spin about the x-axis, the net effect of the Hamiltonian would be exactly the opposite as before. So if I were to do both of these things in succession, if I were to first allow it to evolve freely, then do a flip and allow it to evolve freely for the same amount of time and do another flip, the net effect would be zero. That's the identity. There would be no net spin precession. Yeah. Oh, that's a question or just, okay, sorry. Scratching your head. Okay. So the second half of this, this half cancels the first half. I can't turn it off, but I can undo it. Yeah.
Is this chemical shift sort of relaxation out of the plane where it's spinning?
No. The actual precession frequency is a little bit different from the unperturbed precession frequency, possibly because of the molecular environment. And that might be different for different protons, for example, in a molecule if they are in different chemical environments. So it's just something that might be there. And think of it as a mismatch between the true precession frequency and the frequency I have my oscillator tuned to.
Or you're like switching the sign of the phase between the two frequencies.
Switching the sign of the phase between the two frequencies. Yes, in some ways I process for a little while in one direction, and I flip it over and it processes the opposite direction for a while, and I flip it back, and the net effect was nothing. Yeah. Okay, but I'm going like this because, you know, when you're talking about a single spin, it's almost irresistible to point your finger in some direction and think about a block vector or something. It'd be really sort of semi-classical in your thinking. But the quantum mechanical truth is this. Okay, so now here's what we do. Here's what we do for our refocusing. What we have is this Hamiltonian, the whole Hamiltonian, generates a time evolution v12, and that time evolution includes terms due to this, and due to this. All those guys commute with each other, though, so that's very nice. All right, that's good. So we allow this to evolve according to this Hamiltonian by this. And then we flip both spin 1 and spin 2 by radio pulses. We flip both spins. And then it evolves again. And then we flip them again. And what this does, this net procedure, which I could call delay by t, x flip, delay by t, x flip, okay? What this second part does is it sort of exactly reverses the evolution of both spins. It takes z to minus z. It takes z to minus z, z to minus z, and z to minus z. Oh, but notice what happens when you take z to minus z. You get the negatives of these terms, but this term is unchanged because both spins are reversed. So all of the evolution involving only one of the z's cancels. But you get the evolution, the net effect is the evolution due to only the J coupling. We can isolate that effect from the other effects. We can isolate that effect from the other effects. This refocusing thing is kind of cool, by the way. There's a very nice experiment where this is interesting. So suppose you have a whole bunch of spins lined up. And then you just let them process in their magnetic field for a few milliseconds. And unfortunately, your sample is not in a uniform field. That is to say, your field's a little bit different strength in one place than another, right? Then what will happen is, although you have lots of a magnetic moment at the beginning, because the spins are processing at slightly different frequencies at slightly different places in your sample, they become desynchronized. And it looks like your spin goes away. It looks like the net spin goes away. It looks like looks irreversible, in fact. It looks like irreversibility. It looks like it's all gotten lost. So it looks like it goes away to zero. But then, suppose you flip all of those with a pi pulse. You flip all of those with an x pulse. And then you run them the same amount of time and flip them again. What do you get? you get all that net magnetic moment in your sample back. It's called spin echo. It can be quite dramatic. It can be quite dramatic. I mean, in as much as little barely detectable effects happening to 10 to the 18th nuclei in a sample is dramatic. Okay, but it can be. It looks like this. It looks like the net magnetic moment's gone away, but it's just desynchronization, and you can put it all back by exactly reversing the spins, and then they all exactly reverse according to the local magnetic field. Okay. Anyway. So, all right. So this refocusing allows me to get rid of these terms and keep that term. And if I'd only refocused on the first one, right? If I'd only refocused using the first on the first spin, that would have gotten rid of this term and this term and left this term. And so on. If I had three spins that had J couplings between them, by doing a sequence of delays and X pulses on various spins, I could pick out any one of the terms in the Hamiltonian and have that be the only term that contributes, which is pretty cool. All right, so any questions about this? All right, refocusing. It's a magic way of turning off some parts of the Hamiltonian. You turn it off in the net effect. It's actually always acting, but you found a way to make it some parts of it cancel itself out. All right, so now we've got this. How can we build a 2-qubit gate? Because if we can build a good 2-qubit gate, then we've got all the 1-qubit gates. If we can build a 2-qubit gate, then that opens the way to do quantum computing, right? Okay, so let's see. Here's things we can do. For a given theta, I can do a rotation around about z by theta. I can do this with resonant pulses. I could also do it by a refocusing trick and some time delays, however I want to do that. And I can also make things like this for the second spin. And I can also use refocusing to just get a term like this, which is the J coupling. Okay? And these guys all commute, by the way, which is very nice. They're all just functions of the Z's. So let's see what happens to some basis states. Let's see what happens to some basis states. If I just apply U12, what happens to the basis states is that the spin picks up an e to the minus I phi if the product of the z's is plus, and it picks up an e to the I phi if the product of the z's is minus. And since 0 is the plus eigenstate, 1 is the minus eigenstate, these two guys, 0, 0, and 1, 1, both pick up phases e to the minus I phi, and then the other guys pick up e to the I phi. So that's how this works. Okay? But now let's compose this with the other two. Let's compose this with the other two with the same theta. What do we get? Well, we get this. This upper one, it adds two factors of e to the I theta to this. And so I just get e to the I theta. This adds one factor of e to the I theta and one factor of e to the minus I theta, so it doesn't change that phase, and the same here. But this guy, it adds two factors of e to the minus I theta, and so this e to the minus I theta becomes e to the minus 3 I theta. So what this does is it does the same thing to all of them except the last one, and the last one, it changes the phase differently. So let's choose theta equal to pi over 4. So now these guys are, now I'm deciding how long the delays are and how strong my resonant pulses and so on that I want to make. Let's choose theta equal to pi over 4. So then, up to a factor of e to the I pi over 4, this goes to 0, this goes to the same, this goes to the same, this goes to the same, and this goes to minus the same. This is e to the minus 4 I times pi over 4. So it's e to the minus I pi times pi over 4, minus 1 times that. What is this? It's not a Hadamard. It's a two-qubit gate. Hadamard is a single-qubit gate. It's controlled Z. Yes, it is. There it is. It's controlled Z. We've built controlled Z. And controlled Z, well, we can build it. We can build controlled Z. We can build controlled Mach. And that means that we can build any combination of one and two-qubit gates. And that means we have a universal set. NMR potentially allows us a universal set of quantum gates. A universal set of quantum gates. That's the good news. Of course, we need to be able to address the spins individually with resonant pulses, because we said we can do single qubit unitaries on any of the qubits, right? Any of them. That means that we can address them individually. And what that means is that the resonant frequencies for the different spins had better all be different. So let me give you an example of that. Here's trichloroethylene. It's another one of those great molecules that just has carbon, hydrogen, and chlorine. And the chlorines have those electric quadrupoles that are tumbling around all over the place, so they basically average out to zero. And let's make these out of carbon 13. You can pay extra for that. So we've got a proton, and we've got two carbon 13 nuclei. Now, at first, it looks like we're in trouble because these two carbon 13 nuclei would have the same resonant frequency. Not quite so, because they're in slightly different chemical environments. This guy has a couple of chlorines attached to him. This guy has a hydrogen and a chlorine attached to him, which means that there's a splitting between the resonant frequencies. They're slightly different resonant frequencies. There's a chemical shift of one with respect to the other. And therefore, if we can make resonant pulses for these guys that are very narrow in frequency, we can make resonant pulses that are resonant with this guy but not that guy, or with that guy but not this guy. We could do that. And so we could individually address the carbon 13 nuclei. But in order to do that, we have to make our resonant pulses really narrow in frequency, which means they have to be really broad in time space, in time, right? So this means that this limits our speed. It limits how rapidly we can cause transformations to happen to this guy without affecting that guy. It slows us down. We're limited by the chemical shift between the two nuclei. And I forget what that is, but I think it's a few hundred. Hertz. So we have to make our pulses tens of milliseconds long, at least the ones that are addressing these guys, if I recall correctly. My own experimental quantum computing hasn't quite got up to 3 qubits yet. Yeah?
So if you want to make more qubit systems, do you always have to make bigger molecules?
Yep.
Like, that seems like a terrible way to go, because at some point you're just not going to get the resolution and frequency.
Yeah, that's a problem. And this is one of the challenges to liquid state NMR. Solid state NMR is something different, where you might be using NMR to address, say, impurities in a crystal or something like this. But I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the simplest kind. You had a question.
Just about your molecules, the carbon atoms seem to have 5 bonds each.
Sorry. I should have only put 2 bonds between those. That was a goof. Right. Yeah. Good. Good. Right. There's an extra enthusiastic pair of bonds there. That's embarrassing. Right. Because otherwise it would be like trichloroethine or something, right? Which doesn't make sense. Okay, so. Oh, nuts. All right, so now we get to some bad news, because we have to deal with real systems, alas. And one of the problems is that when we do quantum computing, we'd like to start out with all the qubits in the zero state. But we never get to do that. We never get to do that in NMR. In NMR, we're stuck with a thermal state. for a single spin, that would be something like this. Something times some population times 0 plus some population times 1. And if we look at the ratio of those populations, it's the exponential of, and here I stuck back in the h-bars, so it looks like conventional units, h-bar omega over kt. Well, yeah, omega's big. And h-bar's really tiny, and k's kind of small, and t's pretty... What is this exactly? Well, let's see. For a proton in a 10 tesla field at 300 k, that ratio is 7 times 10 to the minus 5th. So the difference in population, the difference in the amount by which one spin, 0 is favored over 1 in this mixture is very small. It's almost completely mixed. It's almost 1/2 times the identity. It's just a little different from that. Okay, that's how it is. What do we do? Well, what you wind up doing, without going into too much detail, is you use what are called pseudo-pure states. Did you guys work out a problem on pseudo-pure states? Amazing. A pseudo-pure state, of course, is this combination, this mixture of the identity and some pure state. And if we make this all zeros, then in some ways the pseudo-pure state acts like a set of state of all zeros, except all the experimental averages, all the experimental observations, are attenuated by this factor, factor eta, the purity. Okay, everything's attenuated by that factor. But because this thing, you know, for if you're measuring some traceless observable, this thing makes no contribution anyway. This guy is the only one that makes a contribution. And so what you do is you put a lot of molecules in your sample. That's easy. The trick would be to only put 2 or 3. But you can put a lot of molecules in your sample, and then you do the computation on all of these guys at the same time, and they're in a pseudo pure state, or you can arrange it experimentally to be in a pseudo pure state. That's you can make those things out of thermal states. Where the only ones that are favored are the zero, and it's favored by a small amount, and you do your experiment on that, and you look at the attenuated signals. Yeah.
What is the typical value of eta?
Well, for one spin. It's on the order of 10 to the minus 5th times something, right? But for many spins, it goes down with the number of spins. What you can achieve goes down with the number of spins, I'm afraid. And that's why, that's really the thing that makes there to be a horizon of on the order of 10 qubits for liquid state NMR quantum computing. You can go up to 10 qubits, but after that, the pseudo-pure state that you can make because you're really making it out of a thermal state is so attenuated that you really can't get your signal in a reasonable amount of time. Okay. Also, measurement. What can you measure? You know, we talk about in quantum computing, you just measure like what the value of the qubit was. Sorry, you can't really quite do that. But here's what you can do. What you can do is you can just let the spins go. And they process around, and if the spin is not if the block vector of the spin, if you will, is not pointing along the z-axis, it actually wobbles around, and that means that'll produce a radio signal. It's called free induction decay. You'll produce a radio signal. The radio signal, of course, will decay over time because you'll be emitting energy, and the thing will be relaxing toward equilibrium. And it's only the transverse components of the spin that contribute. It's only the x and y terms that contribute to this radio pulse. And by looking at the amplitude of this and its phase, so really looking at the Fourier transform of it very, very carefully, we can determine the ensemble averages for these observables. That's the phase of it relative to the internal oscillator that defines our rotating frame. We can determine ensemble averages, because we got 10 to the 18th spin, so that's okay, of these guys. So we can do some measurements, some kinds of measurements. And in general, what we can do is we can do traceless spin, the measurements of any traceless spin observable, z, x, combinations of those, But to do that, you might have to apply a one qubit gate to transform what you want to measure into one of these guys. And then do free induction decay and measure. So measurement amounts to doing this, which is one of the reasons why you're using billions of molecules, because you're actually detecting the radio signals from the sample, which is from these molecules, and so you have to really have a lot of molecules that have a big enough radio signal to hear. Okay. Finally, these spins are it's really an open system. So the nuclear spins, they're open systems, and they have both longitudinal and transverse relaxation processes. But why are they open systems? Well, let's consider chloroform. This guy, all the spins are interacting with the electrons around them, and they're interacting with each other. And the carbon guy, the carbon is really interacting with the chloroform molecules. They kind of average to zero, but they are kind of a source of noise, or a source of or a place that that in some ways is continually messing a little bit with the carbon atom. And so, in order to describe these processes, what do you need? Yes. It's the Lindblad equation. And in the Lindblad equation for describing this, what you find is that you need about three Lindblad operators. Two of them describe what's called longitudinal relaxation. This describes a process by which spin down gets transformed to spin up. And this describes a process by which spin up gets transformed to spin down. 0 goes to 1 and 1 goes to 0. And they have approximately equal coefficients. And this simple model, this is the simplified model, they are equal. What this means is that the state you decay to is the completely mixed state, 1/2 times the identity, not the thermal state. But this is good enough. Okay? And then there's also something like this, a transverse term. And this transverse term causes coherence to be lost between up and down. So the net effect is both of these things affect the coherences, and this guy also affects the coherences, though it doesn't affect the populations. So here's the story about relaxation times. The populations in the density operator for one spin, we'll talk about one spin only right now, the populations decay toward equilibrium with a certain time constant, T1. I put that in bold because you hear NMR people talk about T1 and T2. Here's what they are. The populations decay with a time constant, T1. And that T1 includes contributions from both of these processes. T1 includes only contributions from these processes. This doesn't affect the populations. But the coherences decay towards zero. The off-diagonal terms in the density operator decay towards zero with a time constant, T2, which is much faster because it gets contributions from everybody. In fact, in general, I just say it that way. So, okay, the coherences decay towards zero with a faster time constant, T2. This is usually the first non-unitary thing that you have to think about. Decoherence, loss of coherence in the Z basis, transverse relaxation, T2. And how short is that? Well, for carbon-13 in chloroform, if you look in chloroform, this guy's got the shortest T2. Because he's the one that's looking at the chlorines. So carbon's got the shortest T2, and it's about 0.3 seconds. That's 300 milliseconds. But that's enough time to do a lot of quantum gates. That's enough time to do scores of 2-qubit gates. And since those single-qubit gates can be done by resonant pulses very rapidly, since these are easy to address individually, for hundreds of single qubit gates before your T2 takes over. And T2 for some molecules can be quite long, seconds. Seconds are not uncommon. Because the spins are nearly isolated, informationally isolated. Not bad. Okay, so last slide. Just think about all of the things that we've talked about that have gotten a workout today. Sometimes it's nice to know that what you're studying is of some use. Not always. I mean, mostly it's cool, but it also occasionally of some use. For example, time evolution operators like this. Yes, yes. Also, rotation operators. I didn't put those up, but rotation operators for spin 1/2 showed up. Heisenberg and Schrodinger pictures and their hybrid in the rotating frame picture. Composite systems. Oh yeah, we talked a lot about composite systems, and they became entangled. Perhaps, you know, we could imagine experiments where that happened. We talked about density operators. Oh yes, yes, density operators were mentioned upon occasion, and especially those thermal density operators that became important. Open system dynamics. Yeah, Lindblad equation actually showed up and had something important to say. Quantum gates, and putting quantum gates together to make quantum information processing. So that's the end. Any questions? Yes.
The translation and longitudinal relaxation processes. What are they really? So you just like put up some Lindblad operators, but where do they come from?
Where do they come from? Okay, so I tend to think of them this way. The transverse relaxation, the decoherence, amounts to the fact that the environment is continually measuring the z component of the spin. The z component of the spin, what the z component of the spin is here. Continually has an effect on the behavior of other systems.
Does that have to do with the chemical
shift? Yeah, it has to do with J coupling, for one thing. Here, you can see that this guy does have J coupling with these guys. These are perfectly good covalent bonds. It's simply that these guys are tumbling around so fast that we said that averaged out. Well, it averages out in average, but also, if you will, it's like a random variable that has zero average but has a variance. Okay, and so that'll produce some noise. And that noise shows up as terms in the Lindblad equation here. And so what happens is this guy is continually coupling with the Z component of this guy through the chemical shift. But then that coupling, which starts to produce some entanglement between them, that's completely masked by its interaction with the rest of the world through its electric quadrupole moment. So what's happening is information about the Z component of this guy is continually leaking into the chlorines, and the chlorines are dumping it into the environment. And that's sort of exactly what happens in a Markov approximation for open system evolution. In that case, because the J coupling favors the Z, the other things average to zero very fast, then it's the principal effect is decoherence, is in the Z direction. But then they're also it's also interacting weakly in all kinds of ways with thermal degrees of freedom of the system. You know, the thing is rotating and bumping into other molecules, and the spin degrees of freedom can exchange energy with those guys. And the relaxation process represents approach to thermal equilibrium. The processes that lead to approach to thermal equilibrium. So that's not as detailed an answer as possibly could be given. But there's some good in that. There's some meat in that answer. Other questions? Okay, this has been fun. We'll see you around.